All right. Welcome back to the Catch Bits Show, everyone. This is one of your co-hosts, Mike Moran, and I'm joined by our usual co-host, Neil Pinchard. Hi there, Neil.
Good afternoon, Mike.
And third co-host tonight, and ever popular Charlie Campagna. Charlie, thanks for joining us again.
My pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
You're a very desired guest. Lots of people write into the show and request more interviews. They want to hear more about what you got. But before we get into knives and history and whatever other nonsense, people got to know what's new in truck talk this week. Neil, you haven't been sliding around on the road, have you? Is it snowing up there yet? Have you gotten any snow? It's March now.
We haven't had we're supposed to get some snow maybe later this week, but so far nothing. And Mike, I did send you a video of a Toyota Tacoma that just hit over 1,000,000 miles.
That's right.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
You guys are famous for your Toyota Tacoma talk and making me feel a little, you know, underprivileged because I drive a Ford. But Ridian called me the other day and said his dad can't make it to the Oregon show. Would I like to ride down to Oregon with him in his Tacoma? So I said yes. So I will ride that 7-8 hours in a Tacoma and feel honored, I'm sure.
Will you pass through Tacoma in the Tacoma?
Yes, we will. Yes, we will.
Hey, that'd be cool.
Wow. Tacoma.
That's been our episode of Truck Talk, I guess. So tonight, we thought we'd pin down two collecting maestros, Neil and Charlie, and really pin them down. And you guys can't see this audio-only podcast, but I can see these guys, and they're squirming in their seats because I've asked them to narrow down their favorite knives to 5, and they've got to come to the podcast today and talk about their favorite 5 knives. And it might be based on a pattern, or maybe they have personal story or history behind the knife. Maybe they stole the knife. I don't know. But they're dying because they can only do 5, I'm sure. But that's what we're going to try and do tonight.
Well, I got to jump in and correct Mike just a little bit. This isn't our 5 favorite knives. These are 5 of our favorite knives. Because as Charlie would attest to nail down your top 5 knives, your top 10 knives, your top 50 knives is not really possible. So my idea was we were just going to pick out 5 knives that we really like and say why. And the idea was, is it based on history? Is it based on sentimental something? Is it a pattern? Is it a shape? Is it just something you go, I just like that knife and why? So that's kind of the idea.
All right. There's Neil coming in over the top with his legalese. Do we have to, can we make some stipulations? Should they be folding knives? Should they have to go in your pocket? Or can these things be broadswords?
I think folding knives will narrow it down enough so we don't run all over the place, you know. You make them, and mostly that's what I think Neil and I collect. So.
I agree with Charlie. Not that we couldn't have a fixed blade or a Gladius sword in there somewhere down the road, but I think for this episode, we're going to probably focus on folding knives. And to say pocket knife might be kind of a stretch because I have at least one that if you put it in your pocket, it'd be sticking out one end. So I think a folding knife would be the best characterization.
Well, Neil, why don't you kick us off with your first favorite knife then?
I would love to start off. So the first knife I picked is an American knife. And I probably lean myself, I lean more towards European knives, but I still love American knives too. So I've got a knife here that is made by Robeson. And Robeson, as most people know, is an old company, a good American company. They made a real quality product. Robeson dates back to around 1893, went up to around 1974. But anyway, I like the knife because, first of all, it's kind of an English Jack pattern. But the real reason I picked this knife, if I turn this over and show these guys, this is a liner lock knife. But the really cool thing is that the liner lock itself is built into the bolster. So most liner locks have a little brass tab that sticks up. People always think of the TL-29s, the World War II era liner locks. I think some collectors really don't realize the liner locks really go way back in history. I mean, in 1906, Cattaraugus had patented a liner lock knife. But this is the only one I'm aware of. I'm kind of showing these guys where they've actually built. And Charlie, have you seen these before? Where they built the liner into a tab that's a cutout in the bolster.
I've seen a different, done a different way. I've seen it yep. done a different way.
Yeah.
I saw a bolster undercut and a tab that popped up from a punch into that.
Interesting.
Into that groove.
Okay.
I didn't put it out here. I've got a few harness jacks to show you, but not that one.
Okay. Very interesting.
But that's all I've seen. But that's an interesting knife. You have a bottle opener on it, and it's on the back side of the blade, which I've never seen that before.
Right. But if you think about it, because it's a liner lock, it can't fold closed. So it's right. When it's opened, it's locked. So you're right. You typically think of the bottle openers being on the other side so that you're working against the back spring. Well, this one, because it's a lock blade, you can put the bottle opener on the back. This also has a fish scaler on here. And real nice jig bone. You know, like I said, Robeson really did make a quality knife. And it's a good looking, good quality knife. This is a pre-war knife. It's probably, I'm guessing, around 1930s. I've done a little research and I've looked at some of the other websites. AAPK guys have talked about these, and there's no definitive time frame, but most guys kind of think they were from the 1930s. So
it sure looks like it is.
It does. It looks like a 1930s piece.
It almost exactly. looks like it could have been made by, you know, Remington.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
The tooling that would have been involved.
Yep.
Sure.
So what is that? Is that like 4 inches long?
That one, I actually had some notes, and that is 4.5 inches is the handle. So it's a little longer because it's kind of a narrow knife. It doesn't look like a bigger knife, but it's a nice slender knife, would fit great in the pocket.
It really plays with your head because of that bottle opener. So let me describe that. The bottle opener, some people have seen the bottle openers on the bottom of a tang of a knife, and then you have a shorter blade. We've seen that with the beer lows, etc. Well, this bottle opener is on the top of the tang, towards the spine of the knife. And also the spine of the blade was a fish scaler?
Yep. It has a fish scaler on there, right. The whole length of the back of the blade.
Well, you would need a long knife to use that fish scaler.
You're right. You're right, Charlie.
If you're a serious fisherman.
Well, that wouldn't be big enough for the fish I catch, but maybe for you guys do.
Is that in Lake Arizona, Mike, or what lake are you talking about?
Where
you
live? I was at the lake this weekend. There's lots of lakes in Arizona.
Okay, I'm not talking about that swimming pool, that little blow-up thing you got in the backyard.
Little kiddie pool, they run a deal.
Yeah. It was a real lake, because I thought it was all just desert and cactuses there.
That's not true, yeah.
Huh, okay.
Nice.
Well,
knife.
That was my first pick, and I'm going to turn it over to Charlie.
Oh, boy. Oh, so we're going to volley this thing back and forth for you guys?
That's what I think we'll
do. Is it going to come down to, like, the grand finale? You're going to hold back for...
No, I think it's just a nice ping pong match.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, a little gentlemanly sharing of knives, but I know this is going to be a competition towards the end. I can see it unfolding.
Well, I'll follow it with a large knife as well. So this was made by Empire for Shapley for diamond. It's a diamond etch knife. It's probably World War II-ish, but it would be before 1930 when Empire closed. So between the 20s and the 30s, I would say, because it's one of their later knives. The interesting thing about it is it's a saddle horn type knife, but it has this Art Deco shape to it. Tony Bowes really liked that knife. I sent him one just like this. And he made a copy of it. And he made one without the lock for Case as a Bowes Case collaboration. So he made a sample for them and they reproduced it in premium steel and so forth.
So Charlie, you're behind that knife.
I am. I inspired Tony and Tony inspired Case. He did make a pattern for one with a lock, but he never made one before he passed. But he gave the pattern to Ken Erickson, and Ken Erickson made one with a lock. So I'm giving you a time. It's quite a beautiful knife. And it has an Empire shield on it. Empire used to use that shield. They were known for it exclusively. It's a modified banner shield that you can etch your name onto and so forth. But I love that shield. And I've since inspired Bill at Great Eastern to use it on my latest harness jack from last year. And he's got that same shield on my harness jack. So anyway, there we are with a great big Deco saddle horn.
Charlie, those are two favorite knives of mine that I do not own. I've seen that, especially that first one, several times, and it is a beautiful knife. And I like how you said Art Deco, because it has these angles, beautiful. It's almost sculpted. I mean,
almost faceted bolsters.
It's faceted. Yes. They're angled. I mean, everything about both of those is just wonderful. And it's so unique. You hold that knife up and you go, it's kind of like looking at old cars, like an old Model A or an old Edsel or something. You look at that and you go, that's a distinctive shape. That was a design by one specific company and just a classic, beautiful pattern.
I feel the same about that pattern. Yeah. I know somebody who has a mint Empire, by the way. When we're offline, I'll get you his name.
Yeah. I'd appreciate if you don't tell anybody else.
I won't.
Oh, very cool.
All right, that's nice. It looks like a big knife, Charlie. How big is that thing?
It is. I better hold that up to my head. I don't have a ruler here. So, Neil, what you got?
Okay, well, I'm going to jump in with another knife that really is one of my favorite knives of all time. This is a Henckels, but it's called a Deerfoot pattern. You can obviously see the bottom is shaped like a Deerfoot. The Henckels made these knives from around the 1870s to the 1930s. But this particular knife is a genuine Damascus blade. It's about the only vintage knife I can think of that had real Damascus as a pocket knife. These models are because of that, they're extremely uncommon. You'll find the regular carbon blade spear point like this, these models once in a while, but to find the Damascus ones, they're really, really rare. And not only did this have a Damascus blade, but I don't know if this shows very well, but there's gold gilding on a floral pattern that's on the blade. If you guys can see that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they actually put, they called it gilding, but it was a gold, layering they actually put on the blade. This is a pretty good size knife. This is, I have my notes here. It's a 5-inch handle knife. It was definitely made as a hunting knife. I mean, in a lot of different German companies made this pattern of a Deerfoot knife. It's a common pattern. Feels really good in your hand because it has a, you know, that the top bolster flares out and the bottom Deerfoot flares out. So when you've got your hand wrapped around it, it's a positive feel. This one happens to have a corkscrew. Some did and some didn't. And this also was a locking blade, but it has this interesting fulcrum in the back, this little lever. So when you flip this lever up and push it towards the blade, it pulls the back spring out so that you can close and release the blade. And then it's in the closed position.
That's a great looking knife. Can you show me the blade again? It looks like it has a pattern. It has a pattern on it.
Well, that blade, Charlie, is a Damascus blade. So it's like I said, it's one of
but
the very-
But it's got a floral pattern.
It has, you're right. It has a floral pattern that is called, I believe it's called relief etched, meaning that it's not etched into the blade. They etch the blade away so that that pattern actually sticks out. Another, very time-consuming process. So they basically, shaved the rest of the blade down to make that little floral pattern actually stick out. It's actually raised. And the only way to do that is to take all the rest of the blade down. So it was a complicated knife to produce, an expensive knife to produce, and just a neat piece. And then it does say on here, I'll have to get my magnifying glass, it says Henkel's. It says J.A. Henkel's Twin Works, Solingen, Germany, right on the blade, not on the tang, but on the blade itself. So again, this is one of my favorite knives. It's just, I always just thought it was just a cool looking knife.
You had that knife in the Henkel's book?
Yes, that's in the Henkel's book. Yep. Yep. So there's a little German. Charlie, what have you got next?
I have a series of knives that I'm going to show you.
Ooh.
That lead up to something I invented.
Wow.
The first is an old T. Allen curved slim trapper-like jack, right? Thomas Allen Sheffield, correct. And actually, this one was used by someone who kept kosher. You see the three marks?
Yeah.
And if you look at the edge of the bone, there are three notches in it. Can you see them?
Right. Oh, I do see the three notches, yeah.
And on the back cap bolster, there are three lines filed into the bolster. Can you see them?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this was probably, for instance, the knife that they used for cutting meat only.
No kidding.
Okay, so that's an aside from what it really getting to as a point. This knife is stag, but it's the core of the stag. It's showing the pith on the inside. Right. So that's how it was cut, this old Thomas Allen. But when I found this knife, I thought, we could make modern knife with this as a feature. So you've heard of first cut stag. That's the good stuff, like this Tony Bowes.
Right.
Nicely fitted, beautiful. As good as any Sheffield maker.
Fantastic.
Or this 2009 Bill Howard's wonderfully fitted stag for this trapper.
Yeah, gorgeous.
Bill refused to put stag on the TC Barlows that I'm a little bit known for, but I convinced him that we could do not first cut stag, not second cut stag, but third cut stag. Third cut stag, showing the pith.
Wow.
The real core of the stag, getting to the waist and recycling that material, which is part of the essence of a Barlow knife that often they swept the floor and used that stuff to make knives, to make those cheap Barlows for everyone. So that's where third cut stag came from. So between Bill and I, we came up with this. And what he did was he cut it so the pith showed, but he was afraid it would shrink. So he dipped it in, that magical glue that everybody uses to fix everything. And filled it with super glue so that it couldn't collapse. But it shows in all different kinds of decorative ways in the handle And that's third cut stag. And it was, so far it's never been used on another knife. But
I had never heard of third cut stag before, Charlie. I mean, second cut's pretty common, but I'd never heard. And what a cool idea, like you say, to use a good material that's already there. I would love to see that compared to bone. Do you see any kind of porousness in the stag like you would a bone? Do you think, is it easy to spot that from bone?
You can see that the edges don't have the those little pores that bone has.
Right, right.
So it's quite okay. Smooth in that huh. Part. Here's that one that we call soup yeah. Bone right next to it. And it's got all the pores and everything in it. But this white part of the stag is without those runnels for the blood vessels that actually right. Run, those mini blood vessels that run in bone, which don't run in stag. Right.
Oh, that's very interesting. Very cool. Very cool. Did he use third cut stag on any other knives that you're aware of other than ones he did for you?
So far as I know, no. This third cut stag, I've seen people add $300 to the cost of the knife because it has third cut stag on it. Hmm. And so that's how rare it is in the collecting community.
Hmm. Wow.
I wish I'd kept a few for later, but I know I don't have that much foresight.
Yeah.
Anyway, I thought that would be interesting for this
very
show.
Neat.
So. Yeah, very neat. Cool.
Well, then I'm going to jump back in with a little knife. This is an Ulster, and this knife is 3 1/4 inches long. I'm not necessarily a huge fan of the gun stock pattern, and they call it a gun stock pattern because it does look like the stock of a rifle. I like this. I don't know. The proportions are just right. I love the blade. It's a spear point, but it has a long pull. It also has stag, you know, not a lot of American companies use stag, you know, for the most part, you know, jig bone was far more common. You do see stag on some knives, but like I said, not common. And I just love this has nice stag on it, a nice shield. I don't think Ulster gets anywhere near the credit that they deserve. Right. You know, whenever yeah. People talk about knives, it's always Case, Remington, some other companies, and Ulster made a ton of knives for other companies. They were a big contract company, but I have a fair number of Ulsters, and I've always thought, man, those are really a high quality fit and finish on this is great. Again, this is a pre-war knife, and man, you can't find a gap or a crack or anything on this thing. It was just really well made.
Ulster made beautiful knives, and that's one of them.
Yeah.
They made gorgeous knives.
That's got a spear main with a long pull, goes straight to the tang, and the yep. Tang is perfectly matched to the bolster, and then it's got a secondary nice pen. It's beautiful.
Secondary long, thin pen blade,
yeah.
You know, great for small, delicate work. Nice kind of a squared cap bolster on the back.
Yeah.
The top bolsters have have some lines, you know, grooved in. I guess you call it a threaded bolster. I don't know if that shows
yeah,
too well.
Yeah.
But and a beautiful Federal shield. Like I said, everything about it, and what a wonderful little what they call a Sunday pocket knife. You know, at 3 1/4 inches, you barely know it's there, but yet you can still do some whittling, some, you know, cutting with it. Just a great small pocket knife.
Quintessential pocket knife. It's great.
You're right. Yeah.
Do you think that was made during the time of Dwight Devine?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, this is definitely, I would say, somewhere in the 1920s, 1930s, right in that ballpark. And Mike, that would be a cool...
Yeah.
I know you're still making single blade, but that'd be a nice single blade model also.
Oh, for sure. I could make
both.
I'd
be thrilled to send you
that long pull, does it go into the cut swedge or does it stop short?
No, it stops right at the
hand.
Yeah, right
gosh.
At. Yeah.
That's cool. That's a good knife.
That's great.
Yeah.
You said that's 3 1/4, Neil?
That is 3. I'm looking at my notes again. 3 1/4 inch handle length. Correct.
Beautiful.
It's an elegant gun stock.
It is elegant. It's just elegant, right?
I've made a lot of gun stocks, but I've made them in the variety of like New York Knife. Or, okay. You know, built, that's what the ones Great Eastern Cutlery makes is.
Right, right.
From New York Knife Company. I'm sure they got theirs from somewhere in England.
But. Right.
I like the fact that that handle is subtle in shape.
It is not, subtle. You're right,
it's
Charlie.
It's not tortured like some gun stocks are.
No, it just has a nice little raised, you know, section on it. And
just enough to know it's a gun stock.
You're right. Yeah. Just but enough barely. To know it's there and not not over the top.
Yeah.
Yep. Beautiful.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay, Mr. Charlie.
I started out my special factory orders with harness jacks back in 2004, 2005. I decided to collect harness jacks because there weren't very many around, and I thought that would be kind to my budget, and I'd only find one every now and then. So I couldn't find too many. I advertised for them, and out they came from under the rocks, everything. People were pointing them at me, saying, give me money, give me money. And the price went up, and it just went crazy. So I decided when they finally disappeared that I should get somebody to rebear them, get them out into the public again. They disappeared when automobiles took over society. Horses disappeared, and nobody needed to fix their reins or their horse gear any longer. So harness jacks just disappeared. So this is an old Empire. It's quite worn. It's got another of my favorite shields on it, a double bump. But it's got a sheepfoot blade, which you almost never see on a harness jack.
Right.
And that's a rare one. And it's got a very typical Empire punch on it. They actually machined out the inside, which was probably a very lengthy process.
Yeah.
And they made that punch for other brands, many other brands. So harness jacks became pretty popular. And now I have a modern one made in that same vein by our good friend, Radiant.
Oh, that's beautiful. Oh, nice. Holy cow.
Yep. A real nice job. Nice long pull, hand jig bone, hollow ground punch, just beautifully machined. So it's got a concave face on it, and it cuts a hole in leather just perfectly.
Oh, it's fantastic.
I test every one that I make. So there we go. The harness jack.
That is beautiful.
A brief
Do you know
history.
If Ridian made any other harness jacks or just the one for you?
I don't know. I'll ask him. I'll see him soon, so I'll ask him.
Yeah.
Let me show you one more. Ken Erickson, no longer making knives.
Yeah.
He made this one, nice spear blade, and one of the most beautiful custom punches I've ever seen.
Oh.
All hand ground.
Yeah. Hollow ground punch.
Yeah, deep. Hollow ground
deep.
Punch. That.
Yeah,
just beautiful. And it also shows why knife makers refuse to make harness jacks, because that punch takes longer than a blade by weeks.
Oh, yeah. Sure it does. Absolutely.
Here's the back of it.
All I can think of is all the hand sanding he must have done inside that. Once he gouged that out, Mike, do you think he spent hours with his just a thumb and sandpaper smoothing out that inside?
No, but I'm sure he had to come up with some technique. I don't know what it was, but it's got a satin finish, it looks like, inside.
Yep. To get that even and tapered like that must be a feat of skill.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Charlie, if you didn't open up that blade, I would have swore that was a New York knife. That is such a classic, old-looking knife. I mean, it's just a beautiful pattern. That looks like an Empire or a New York or any number of great old companies. Challenge. I mean, my goodness, that could have been any of the best old makers without seeing the name.
I sent him a Valley Forge, and this is almost an exact replica.
Huh.
Valley Forge made a nice punch like that also.
Yeah. Wow.
Don't know how, but I don't have that one in front of me. Huh. So the harness jack, a little flavor of the past.
No,
not fantastic. Often seen today.
Well, I'm an old switchblade guy. I mean, I basically started out many, many years ago collecting switchblades.
No cops here.
and no cops here. And I've always loved them.
Oh, God.
And like so many of us, you know, the longer you collect, the more you look for some things that are just kind of odd and unusual. And this is a German made knife. All the blade stamp says is Qualitat Solingen. And Qualitat just means quality in Germany. There's no maker's mark on this. I think maybe this was made by Henry Kaufmann. Kaufmann made a lot of different unusual knives. They patented a lot of stuff. This is a post-war knife, I'm guessing from the 1950s. But the really cool thing about this is I showed that Henkels earlier that had that backlock. The Germans love that backlock design. This knife, if you see this lever on here, when this lever is pulled away, there's a scissors mechanism, and maybe it shows better this way. So instead of this actually lifting the back lock, it pivots on a pin, and it's almost like a scissors, and that other part of the scissors opens up that back spring and pulls it away from the blade so that you can close the blade, and then it locks. And it's got a spring, a leaf spring inside of there, so that when you fire this, the kick spring just kicks that blade open, and then it locks in place. But again, I love it because of this really unusual release mechanism. It's a little awkward to use. It's got a knurled edge on there. If you can kind of see that knurling, maybe it's always tough with these cameras. But right on here, there's kind of a knurled edge, so your thumb has a little bit of a grip to push on that. And that, like I said, that pushes away, and you can see that it's scissoring that back spring away. Clever mechanism.
Wow. Great. What kind of psychopath thinks that up?
The Germans, when everybody thinks about switchblades, they think about usually either Italian stilettos because of all the movies. They think of some of the old Americans had phenomenally great, press button and, Case made a great lever, K-Bar, all the big companies made really good switchblades pre-World War II. But the Germans made more unusual mechanisms than probably all the companies combined. They had so many different mechanisms. You always think about that lever release, Hubertus or Boker, which was the most common, but they made lots of stuff like this. And then this knife also has a nice little folding spear pen blade in the back. It has a corkscrew. It's hard to find a German knife without a corkscrew. They love corkscrews.
After you stab the guy, you want to celebrate a little bit.
That's right.
A little bubbly.
Yep. And it has one more kind of interesting tool. This, you can see it has kind of a hook. That hook was to pull shotgun shells out of a stuck barrel. It has a screwdriver on the end, which you see in a lot of camping knives. They'll have screwdrivers in the end of a bottle opener. But that hook, like I said, was made to hook onto a shell puller and pull it out. The really interesting part is there's a little hole in the center. See that little hole? Do you guys know what that hole is?
It's a really small hole, maybe 50 thou in diameter.
Yep. You wouldn't commonly know. That's to pull out pin fire shells from European guns. I don't know if any Americans ever had pin fire shells, but it was really popular throughout Germany, France, a lot of Europeans. And that was probably from I can't give you the exact date. I'm thinking mid 1800s to real early 1900s. But on the shells, they actually had a little pin that stuck up. And when the hammer hit that pin, it would fire the bullet off. Well, those also would sometimes stick, and you'd hook this on the end of that little pin and then pull it back out of the back of the breech of the barrel.
So that goes back in history. That must be an old knife.
Well, but it's not an old knife. It's the same. The Germans loved shell puller knives where they had the claws built in. And Charlie, I know you've seen those. Mike, you have.
Yeah, the more traditional type of cartridge extractors.
Correct. And usually it was 12 gauge and 16 gauge or 12 and 20. And they had two different claws on the two different sides. Well, for the most part, you didn't need those claws after World War II, but they just kept putting them on because it was just something they'd always done. And this is kind of the same thing. I think that they just put this on more because of character, more because we'd always done it that way. And maybe there's some old fellows still shooting, shotguns or old antique guns that have these shells that get stuck and they still want something to pull them out. Personally, I think it's more just because of the nostalgia.
There could have been some guy in the basement, named Klaus, he just didn't get the message during the war. He just sat there for 4 years and cranked those things out. He pressed out 60 million of those.
And then some guy told Klaus, you know, they make these plastic shotgun shells that don't get stuck.
What? His mind was blown.
What are you talking about?
Impossible.
Impossible. So maybe.
So Neil, when you describe that mechanism that unlocks the blade, it's kind of like a bar that's got knurling on it. And it's where you would think a shield for our listeners. It's where you would think a shield would be.
Correct.
And you kind of push that bar out and it almost acts like the end of a handle of a scissors.
Yep. It's like a scissors. And the pivot pin, you can actually see the pivot pin in the bolster. The pivot pin for this sits right up above. And if you look with a magnifying glass, you can see the pin. It's above the pivot pin for the blade. And that's the pivot pin for this. And then there's another little piece in there, like I said, that acts as the pair of scissors. It's just a really unique, bizarre mechanism.
Then that is not in your switchblade book, is it, that knife?
I don't remember if it is or isn't, Mike, to be honest with you. I think Charlie can attest that the older we get, the less I remember.
gosh, talking to two old guys tonight.
We're talking to two old guys.
I don't know where that knowledge goes, but it's no longer here.
No. Well, it might be there. It's just stored way back in the back.
Yeah. Yeah, you got to send somebody way back here to get it.
Okay, I have a favorite knife.
Oh.
And this is my favorite lamb foot knife.
Wow.
Oh, boy.
And this is a Joseph Rogers. It's in great shape.
Beautiful.
It's got nicely worm-grooved handles.
2 mega flutes through the bolsters.
Right. 2 great big rat tails, I guess you'd call them.
Stovepipe kick.
And it's just in fine shape. And so that is the inspiration for the one that I had Great Eastern make. This is the one that really turned the crank and said, Charlie, you need this knife and you need to share it with the rest of the world. So Bill made 500 of them for me. And they're just as beautiful. Half have ebony and half were done with a nice jig bone. The only thing he wouldn't do was stamp real lamb foot knife on the blade, but it's just too expensive and too fraught with danger to stamp a blade. Because sometimes when he stamps a blade, he has to go back and straighten them all because they've all bent crooked. There you go. Lamb foot knife. Great knife and a great size too. This is a long one.
I am lucky enough to own both those knives that Charlie just showed. I have a vintage double fluted one that I had showed Charlie before, a vintage Rogers, and one of Charlie's Way North Lamfoot, and they are both exquisite. It's another knife that is so elegant. It fits well in your hand. When you look at it, you go, that's just a beautiful knife. It just has this long, slender, curved line shape. I love the long blade in there. Again, sorry that we don't have a visual show here, but they are just beautiful knives. And you can see these online, of course. You can see them. There's a whole Guardians thread on blade forums. So it's a beautiful piece, Charlie. and Bill certainly did that Rogers justice by recreating your modern knife.
Did a good job. Yeah. I have a confession to make.
Uh-oh.
Oh, boy.
I bribed a GEC engineer to add a couple of thou to that spring so that it would have a very firm pull.
Oh, really?
Because it was in a time when GEC was making softer and softer pulls on their knives.
Right,
you know?
Right.
And I said, please, please, I'll do you a favor. And I did him a favor. And he snuck that extra thick spring in there. And all the production knives came out just perfect.
That was Randy that you slipped money to?
No names.
Maybe you guys can share a prison cell. I don't know. Maybe there's a prison near the border somewhere.
Well, as long as we can bring our knives in with us, we're okay.
Yeah. Well, back in the old days, you could bring your knives in with you to prison.
Probably.
You know that, huh, Mike?
What's that?
I said, Mike, you do know that for a fact?
Yeah, I don't know for a fact, but I've read many a history book that describes that.
Yeah.
So while we're on the subject of Lamfoot, it came up on Blade Forums, Neil, that Joseph Rogers didn't put a center liner in a knife. And here are two Joseph Rogers knives with no center liner.
Right.
All right. So we got two jack knives with two blades each and no middle liner.
No middle liner. This is an old one. And this one is a more modern one, now produced by somebody else. Joseph Rogers doesn't own the name anymore. You can tell by the etched blade instead of the
right,
instead of the stamping and so forth.
Yeah.
And it's also been rehandled. They put them out with plastic handles. And as a gift, somebody had this stag put on this one.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah. Oh, that's cool.
Do you know who did it? Was that a Glenn job?
This was a Glenn job.
Oh, it's beautiful.
And it was commissioned. And it was commissioned by No Tracks.
Huh.
So it was one of the regulars on the forum.
Huh.
Old friend of mine. It was a birthday present.
Huh. Very neat.
Very cool. You know, that's really a good, Charlie, you mentioned the plastic handles thing. There seems to be like more and more guys getting into modding old pocket knives or new pocket knives. And that's an untapped market. There's millions of, I've seen boxes, crates full of knives with plastic handles on that are great knives. They just,
right. I agree.
Those plastic handles on, take those babies off, give it some nice, useful handles, pretty up the holsters. Boy, that'd be something fun to do.
That's right.
A side business for somebody.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, for sure. You could literally make that into a business. A.G. Russell probably would have done that. He's probably one that put the plastic handles on in the first place.
Creating future work for himself.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He's like, yeah, if I make it that long, I'm gonna rip these handles off, put stag on there, charge $600, sell the knife twice. What a mastermind.
So, Neil, I saw you reaching for another knife.
I have my final knife tonight is a monster. This knife is 6 3/4 inches long. It's a Sheffield piece, and probably one of my absolute favorite patterns are horseman's knives. So they fall into the sportsman category, meaning that we have multiple usable blades. But the horseman to me is special because all the horsemen have that horse pick on the end. So for some reason, I just love that horse pick. I love that. And they use those for pulling the stones out of horses' hoofs back in the early 1800s, right up until the early 1900s, basically. Like Charlie said, when the cars started coming around, that was the end of a lot of tools that harness jacks and horse hoofs were no longer really needed. This has a big locking spear blade. And this happens to be what they call a picklock. Everybody thinks that Italians had all the picklock knives. No, they were around 100 years before that. And the picklock basically means that there's a tab on the back of the back spring that you have to pull away with your finger, and then that unlocks the blade so that you can close it. This also happens to have, because it's a big knife, it's got a really big saw blade. I mean, a usable saw blade. I mean, you could cut some pretty substantial tree limbs with this, not just budding and pruning, but you could hack away a pretty good sized limb with that big saw blade.
That knife sounds different from all other knives. It's got such as big blades.
It has a real clunk to it. This has a real nice triangle-shaped punch. And again, that could have been for leather work, for boring a hole through a lot of different things. Another long-lost art is the button hook. And the button hooks, you know, people think, oh, what do you need a button hook for? Well, I mean, they use button hooks on men's boots, you know, lumberjacks. A lot of those guys had button hooks. They'd have to reach in there and pull that string out and hook it around a tab. And so button hooks were a big deal in the mid-1800s. to real early 1900s, and then they're gone too. Another lost.
So, Neil, did you say that's a Sheffield knife?
Yep, this knife is Sheffield. This was made by Needham Brothers. Needham Brothers were, I think, established about 1851. This particular knife probably dates to, I'm guessing, 1870s, 1880s. If you see the word England on a knife, you know that it was made after 1891, imported to America. But that's not necessarily, a lot of guys think, well, if there's no England, then it has to be an old knife. Well, that's not the case. In fact, they were importing a lot of knives to Canada, even in the early 1900s, that did not say England. I have catalogs showing that. And so it was only America, because of the Tariff Act, that required that you had to have England stamped on the blade, usually on the tang. But I'm kind of going off on a tangent, but this doesn't have England on here. And this is an older knife. It dates, like I said, to the late 1800s. It also has a nice screwdriver, which a lot of these knives had built into the liner. So you can see it kind of sticking up there.
Yep.
We were kind of joking earlier about there's some knives that you could call that a pocket knife, but my God, you'd have to have an awful deep pocket and a big pair of suspenders. That's a heavy knife. That's got to be.
What made you save that knife for last? I mean, you got tremendous knives. This is not like anything extravagant.
To me, this was just a nice example of a using. It's a little like Charlie's talking about the harness jack. I like this because this is, they call this an honest knife. This wasn't meant to be a showpiece. I mean, to me, it's a beautiful knife. I mean, I'd call it a showpiece, but some guy used this knife. It was a tool. It was something that, you know, some guy had on his camping trips out in the wilderness somewhere. And it just represents something that was really important as an axe or a canteen, just an absolute great tool.
Beautiful.
That's the end for me for today. Charlie, I think you might have one more.
So I talked about the harness jacks and I talked about third cut stag, but I didn't talk about the Barlows in particular. And I must say, this is really my favorite knife. Not only one of my favorite patterns, but this actual knife has been in my pocket since 2012. It's got my initials on it. I sharpen it once a year, whether it needs it or not, because it's got such great steel in it. It just holds an edge. Every once in a while, a strop takes care of it, and that's it. And I open boxes and my mail and everything else, but that's the knife right there. And that really got me into special factory orders. And this one next to it is a prototype. And you can see how quite smooth it is. It's saw cut. If I can get an angle, it can show a little bit of the lines in it. But when Bill, you can see the lines there. When Bill sent me the saw cut, I said it wasn't deep enough. After about a dozen knives, including those two, he recut the bone so that you could really see the saw cut. And there you can see, if I get the right light on it, it shows up.
You can, absolutely. Yeah.
So it's much more saw cut. But this particular knife from Great Eastern, let's see, it's got a prototype. And PPP means it's the first one of that pattern that they made. Set the Barlows back in the face of collectors. Nobody was making Barlows. And I told Bill, you got to do it. You got to do it. I begged him to do it. And he did it. He went full whole hog. I designed the TC there to represent his Tidiute cutlery brand. And so he had that stamped, forged into the bolster. So it's actually forged in, not laser cut. And every maker in North America started making Barlows. They came from every company that was still in process. So it just takes the right knife at the right time. And there it is, the Barlow knife.
Those are great, Charlie. It's almost like you can just envision Mark Twain talking about that exact knife. And I love how you carved your initials into the handle. I mean, every kid in America did that in the old days. So very cool, Charlie.
So I'm just bragging here, but I think it's worth it. I think that's the backside.
It's beautiful.
The pile said.
The other thing I learned was don't loan knives to Charlie. He'll put his initials on them.
I'm going to sneak another one in here. No, we're supposed to stop it.
I knew
stop at him. Five. But I sent you that write-up I made about this knife.
You did.
It's one of Bill's greatest knives. You see how it's semi-sunk, that's called.
Yep.
So we've got a Congress knife, maybe 3¼ inches. What is that?
No, it's big. It's big.
Oh, it's big?
It is 3¾.
3¾ Congress.
3¾.
Rounded bolsters.
Rounded bolsters, semi-sunk joints with a Warncliffe main blade. And you can tell I've used this knife quite a bit. I've carried it quite a bit. It's wonderful. Beautiful. In the pocket.
Yeah.
I'll repeat, wonderful in the pocket. And it's just the greatest carry knife ever there was in any pocket.
Charlie, it looks like it's wonderful in the hand, too, because with that curve, it must just fit beautifully in the palm of your hand. Yeah. Yeah, with the blade out.
I have a fairly wide hand. You can see that it fills the hand. Sticks out both ends, right?
And you called those handles tomato?
Tomato acrylic. People who make fountain pens, turn pens, you know?
Yeah.
That's where that material started being used.
Huh.
Yeah. And I've made that knife, Charlie. I don't know if you knew that, but I've made that.
You've made it?
Yeah. I ripped it straight out of Creating GC. I didn't change anything because what I really like about that knife, well, first I like that Warncliffe on a Congress, and then it had a sheep's foot on there. But
single
what I
spring.
Really, what I really liked about it, single spring, is that the nail nick is perfectly centered over a perfectly centered shield.
Oh, which
appealed to me.
Yeah, you're right, Mike.
Yeah.
There it is.
Yeah, I made that knife. There's only one of them out there. I pattern it and everything, so I've got it ready to make when I get back in the mood of things. But it's tricky to get both blades in there, but it's doable.
And it just lays in your pocket so nice.
Yeah,
I'll bet.
And a straight edge is very handy to have.
Right.
And I think Bill calls it something like Easy Congress or something like that.
Easy Pocket. Yeah.
Easy Pocket.
I think so. When it's open, it's got a little bit of a sharp bump here from this blade. But
Yeah.
But it can lie between your fingers.
Your fingers. I was just thinking that same thing, right? So it wouldn't be a problem. Yep.
Yeah. No, I can't feel it.
It's my finger. I didn't recognize that knife at first because it looked small. Maybe it's the color of the
big
acrylic.
I don't big know. Hands.
Big hands. Charlie's got large hands. Man hands.
Yes.
Thanks for letting me sneak that knife in.
Oh, absolutely.
Well, Dale's probably going to demand an extra knife for him.
A redo. Yeah. Next week, I'll have two extra.
Yeah. Well, we got the Legalese, the top five of some of my favorite knives. So left the door wide open for 10,000 more top five favorite knives.
That's right. Hey, I did. I meant to mention this when I was talking about that Robeson, and I wanted to give a shout out to Tom Kelevic. Tom is I've known that he was a longtime collector of Robeson knives, and he wrote this real nice little pamphlet on the history of Millard Robeson, the founder of Robeson. There's not a lot of pictures of knives, but there's some great, storyline, some great history of, like I said, the owner of Robeson himself. So if anybody has a chance to get that book, I was sent this by a friend of Tom's, who's Brent Morris. And Brent was kind enough to send me a copy for free. I think that Tom was actually sending a lot of these out to different people that were interested for free.
He sent one to me also.
Oh, good, Charlie. Good. Yeah.
How do people get those pamphlets, Neil?
You know, I don't know. I just saw it advertised. I saw it mentioned in Blade Forums on a certain thread, and it just said, if anybody's interested in this, I'd be happy to send these out. And like I said, this Brent was a real nice fellow, and he is a neighbor or a friend of Tom's, and he just mailed these out in a little packet. And I was thrilled to get it, and I wanted to make sure that Tom received some credit for writing this nice small pamphlet.
It's great. I've read it a little while ago now.
Yeah.
Hey, I just got my Knife magazine today, and I haven't had a chance to read more than just flip through it, but I saw an ad that said Waterville is back. So, Charlie or Mike, do you guys know who's producing the Waterville brand again?
Mm.
Interesting.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
I don't. Do you know, are they stamped Waterville Manufacturing or
Waterville MFG? Mike, I just saw a little 2-inch by 3-inch ad in Knife Magazine, and all it just said Waterville is back, and it had a picture of a few knives in there, and I didn't have more than 3 seconds to quick look at it, so I don't know.
Interesting. For our listeners, Waterville is important because it was one of the early manufacturers. But one of the early manufacturers in New York, right upstream from New York City, and it had employed mostly Sheffielders, almost exclusively. And a lot of them had fled Sheffield because they were little rebel rousers, part of the Chartist movement there, and were hiding out in the United States. But it finally fell apart and became, some of those guys went on and formed New York Knife Company. But Waterville is extremely important, and they made amazing knives. I got to pick up a little pearl-handled dainty one this past year, little 2-inch. Waterville knife in mint condition.
That was beautiful. Far and few between. Charlie, I don't know if you have a Waterville or not, or a couple of them, but boy, there are darn few Waterville mark knives out there.
I have a few, at least three.
Yeah. Okay. So 1840s, 1850s in the United States, they had some of the best Sheffield cutlers.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly.
Yeah. I was going to say, interestingly, Waterville was based, I have this like theory about early knife manufacturers, because they had to have some of the tools. Waterville's kind of, that story's famous because the beginning of the downfall was they required the cutlers to start buying and bringing in their own tools. But my theory has always been that they had to not only have water power, but they needed to have a source for tools and obviously for raw materials. And you almost always find in these early manufacturers in the United States, a file manufacturer in town as well.
Right, exactly. Yep.
So there's some interesting history, and one of these days I'll put pen to paper, but there's interesting history with the file manufacturer that was right next to Waterville. Very interesting history and some fights over contents locked in a safe and people died. And it's quite fascinating, the history there. But if you think about it, they had to have a constant supply of files.
Right.
I think files were bigger in the industry back before the last century.
Well, it's the original tool of precision, right?
Right.
Well, boys, this might be a good place to wind her down.
I think for now.
All right. Well, we want to thank everybody for listening into this episode, if you've made it this far. And we want to thank Charlie for coming on once again, one of our most demanded guests of all time. And hopefully it won't be the last time, Charlie. We appreciate you stopping by.
We always have good guests. Charlie's one of my favorites. So back again and again and again.
Anytime.
Good.
Let me know. Great.
All right. Thanks. Well, thanks everyone for listening along, and we'll catch you on the next episode.